When Noam Chomsky and Edward Herman published Manufacturing Consent in 1988, they struck a nerve that still resonates today. The book, which Warren Buffett once called the most important media analysis of our time, has become required reading in journalism schools worldwide and inspired a generation of media critics. The documentary based on the book became one of the most successful Canadian documentaries ever made. Yet, despite its influence, the core message remains as relevant and as contested as ever. At the heart of Manufacturing Consent lies the propaganda model, a framework explaining how mainstream media functions as a system for communicating messages that support the powerful interests dominating private and governmental activity. Unlike the traditional view that media serves as an independent check on power, Chomsky and Herman argue that structural factors filter news and shape it to serve elite interests. This isn't a conspiracy theory about journalists receiving secret orders. Rather, it's an institutional analysis of how media naturally aligns with power through five systematic filters that determine what becomes news. First, media ownership concentration and profit orientation ensure that giant corporations controlling news outlets prioritize business interests. By the time of the book's publication, just 23 corporations controlled most American media. Today, that number has shrunk to just 9 transnational conglomerates: Disney, Warner Bros. Discovery, Comcast, Paramount Global, Sony, Fox, and a few others that determine what most Americans see, hear, and read. Second, advertising as the primary revenue source makes media dependent on selling audiences to advertisers rather than providing information to citizens. This creates what one CBS executive proudly called their client audience profile tool, helping advertisers target wealthy consumers while ignoring less profitable audiences. When public television station WNET aired a documentary critical of multinational corporations, Gulf Plus Western immediately withdrew funding, complaining the program was virulently anti-business, if not anti-American. The message was clear. Content that might disturb consumers or question corporate power threatens the business model. Third, media reliance on government and corporate sources creates a symbiotic relationship where journalists depend on powerful institutions for daily news. The scale is staggering. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce alone had a $65 million budget for research, communications, and political activities in 1983. These sources subsidize media by providing press facilities, advance copies of speeches, and press conferences that reduce news-gathering costs. Journalists become reluctant to offend these primary sources, creating a dependency relationship that shapes coverage. Fourth, FLAC, organized negative responses to media content, disciplines journalists who stray too far from acceptable narratives. Organizations like Accuracy in Media, AIM, whose funding grew from $5,000 in 1971 to $1.5 million in the early 1980s, with support from 8 oil companies and numerous corporate sponsors, exists specifically to harass media and pressure them to follow corporate agendas and right-wing foreign policies. Fifth, dominant ideology, originally anti-communism but evolving into broader pro-capitalist, pro-American exceptionalism, serves as a powerful control mechanism. This ideological filter helps divide the world into worthy and unworthy victims, legitimate and illegitimate governments, and frames issues within acceptable boundaries. Together, these filters operate like invisible hands, guiding media toward conclusions that support existing power structures, not through conspiracy, but through institutional logic and market forces. Perhaps the most compelling evidence for the propaganda model comes from comparing how media treats similar victims differently based on political utility. Chomsky and Herman meticulously document this pattern through case studies that reveal a stark double standard. Consider the 1984 murder of Polish priest Jerzy Popieluszko by Polish police. As a victim in a Soviet bloc country, Popielushko received massive media attention, 10 front-page stories in the New York Times, 3 editorials condemning his killers, and extensive television coverage with graphic details of his torture and murder. The media aggressively sought high-level responsibility, asking if orders came from the top of the Polish government or even Moscow. Yet, when similar or worse atrocities occurred in U.S. allied countries, the victims became unworthy and received minimal coverage. Father Rutilio Grande's 1977 murder in El Salvador, a pivotal event that radicalized Archbishop Oscar Romero, received virtually no U.S. media coverage. When Romero himself was assassinated while saying Mass in 1980, the coverage was brief and lacked the outrage directed at communist crimes. The New York Times published no editorial condemning or even mentioning the murder. Even American victims weren't exempt from this double standard. When 4 American churchwomen, Mara Clark, Jean Donovan, Ida Ford, and Dorothy Cazell, were raped and murdered by Salvadoran National Guard members in December 1980, media coverage was restrained. Secretary of State Alexander Haig falsely claimed the women were killed running a roadblock, while UN Ambassador Jean Kirkpatrick suggested they were political activists, implying they were legitimate targets. The pattern extended to Guatemala, where 23 religious workers were murdered between 1980 and 85 with minimal media attention. When American priest Stanley Rother was murdered, the Times published only a tiny back-page article with no follow-up. This double standard isn't coincidental. It serves political purposes by directing public outrage toward official enemies while minimizing crimes committed by U.S. allies, receiving American military and economic support. The media doesn't need explicit instructions to follow this pattern. It emerges naturally from the 5 filters shaping news production. Another revealing case study examines how media portrays elections differently depending on whether they occur in U.S. allied or enemy states. In client states like El Salvador and Guatemala during the 1980s, elections were portrayed as steps toward democracy, despite occurring amid massive state terror and without meaningful opposition participation. In enemy states like Nicaragua, similar or better electoral conditions were dismissed as shams or rigged. The 1982 and 1984 Salvadoran elections occurred while the country was under a state of siege, with thousands seized, tortured, and murdered for alleged subversive actions. The only substantial critical newspapers had been violently eliminated. La Crónica del Pueblo closed after its editor and employees were murdered by security forces, while El Independiente was shut down when the army destroyed its plant. Over 30 journalists were murdered since the junta took power. Yet U.S. media praised these elections, focusing on long voting lines and high turnout while ignoring that voting was legally required, with monetary penalties for non-voters and IDs stamped to identify those who didn't participate. The defense minister warned that failure to vote would be considered treason. Meanwhile, Nicaragua's 1984 election, which international observers like the Latin American Studies Association found reasonably fair, was dismissed by U.S. media as a sham. Though Nicaragua had better electoral conditions, voting wasn't legally required, ballots were secret, no journalists were killed by state terrorists, and opposition parties could organize, media coverage was overwhelmingly negative. The New York Times coverage quantifiably demonstrated this bias. For El Salvador, the Times focused on election mechanics and personalities while ignoring basic democratic conditions like press freedom. For Nicaragua, the opposite occurred. Coverage emphasized fundamental conditions for free elections that were never mentioned regarding El Salvador. This pattern reveals how media frames democracy not based on actual democratic conditions, but on alignment with U.S. foreign policy goals. Elections in client states legitimize U.S. support regardless of conditions, while elections in enemy states are delegitimized regardless of their comparative fairness. The alleged KGB Bulgarian plot to assassinate Pope John Paul II in 1981 stands as a compelling example of how mainstream media can abandon fundamental journalistic principles when a story aligns with prevailing Cold War narratives. This case demonstrates how unsubstantiated theories can gain widespread acceptance through selective reporting and political convenience. When Turkish right-wing extremist Mehmet Ali Agca shot the Pope in St. Peter's Square, his initial statements contained no mention of foreign involvement. It was only after spending 17 months in Italian prison, during which he received numerous visits from Italian intelligence officials and magistrates with clear political motivations, that Agca suddenly confessed to being hired by the KGB and Bulgarian secret services. This dramatic shift in his story raised immediate red flags among careful observers. The media's embrace of this conspiracy theory began with Claire Sterling's sensational Reader's Digest article and an NBC TV special report in September 1982. When Agca conveniently named specific Bulgarian officials in November, the story gained additional momentum. The subsequent media coverage was dominated by three key figures: Sterling herself, former CIA officer Paul Hens, and political writer Michael Ledeen. Analysis of television coverage revealed these three accounted for 76% of airtime on three McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour segments, with no opposing viewpoints presented. This echo chamber effect effectively shut out alternative perspectives and critical analysis. The narrative contained numerous logical inconsistencies that the mainstream media largely ignored or downplayed. Security experts questioned why Soviet intelligence, renowned for their professionalism and careful planning, would entrust such a sensitive operation to an unstable right-wing criminal with no prior connection to communist causes. The alleged operational details defied basic intelligence tradecraft. Bringing Agca to Sofia for instructions would have needlessly compromised his cover, while having Bulgarian agents directly participate in the attack would have eliminated any possibility of plausible deniability, a crucial element in covert operations. Alternative explanations, particularly the possibility that Agca had been coached during his imprisonment, were marginalized in media coverage. When such theories were mentioned, they were dismissively labeled as the more sinister view and attributed only to critics on the political left. Crucial evidence supporting the coaching theory was consistently downplayed, including Agca's suspicious knowledge of details about Bulgarian defendant Antonov's apartment building that didn't match reality, suggesting his information came from photographs shown to him rather than personal experience. The media's commitment to the conspiracy narrative persisted even as the case unraveled. When Italian courts failed to convict the Bulgarian defendants in 1986, many outlets rationalized the outcome without examining their own role in promoting an unsubstantiated theory. Even more telling was the media's muted response when former CIA officers Melvin Goodman and Harold Ford testified before Congress that CIA's professional analysts had concluded no Bulgarian connection existed. Their revelation that CIA leadership had deliberately politicized intelligence to support the Reagan administration's propaganda campaign received minimal coverage, and few outlets acknowledged their role in perpetuating what had become a thoroughly discredited narrative. This episode reveals how media organizations can become willing participants in political messaging campaigns, sacrificing journalistic skepticism and investigative rigor when stories align with dominant ideological frameworks and institutional biases. The propaganda model provides a comprehensive framework for understanding media behavior during the Vietnam War, directly challenging the persistent right-wing narrative that an adversary press undermined the war effort. Through 1967, television coverage maintained an overwhelmingly optimistic portrayal of American military progress, with prominent network anchors like Walter Cronkite and David Brinkley largely accepting and amplifying the government's characterization of the war as a noble defense of South Vietnam against communist aggression. Media organizations systematically sanitized the war's brutality through explicit editorial policies. NBC, ABC, and CBS each maintained strict guidelines to delete excessively grisly footage, including scenes of civilian casualties, napalm victims, and the aftermath of bombing raids. Fred Friendly, former CBS News president, later acknowledged this selective editing helped shield the audience from the true horror of the war, creating a sanitized version that bore little resemblance to the ground reality. War correspondents frequently complained about these restrictions, noting that their most powerful footage never made it to American television screens. Coverage displayed a profound American-centric bias, with an estimated 95% of broadcast time devoted to American military efforts and perspectives. Despite South Vietnam being the ostensible beneficiary of U.S. intervention, interviews with South Vietnamese leaders were rare and superficial. More tellingly, Vietnamese civilians, whether supporters or opponents of the war, were virtually invisible in mainstream coverage, their voices and experiences systematically excluded from the narrative. The Tet Offensive in 1968 temporarily disrupted this carefully managed coverage when reporters found themselves in the midst of bloody fighting with significantly reduced military control over their movements. This brief window of more realistic reporting, showing the vulnerability of even supposedly secure areas, had a profound impact on public perception. Walter Cronkite's famous editorial declaring the war a bloody stalemate reflected this shift. Following Tet, as influential voices within the U.S. establishment began questioning the war's costs and benefits, network coverage pivoted away from battlefield reporting toward the peace negotiations in Paris. However, even as public opinion turned decisively against the war, television news never fundamentally re-examined its core assumptions about the conflict as a struggle to defend democracy against aggression. The failure to explore deeper questions about American involvement and strategy left the public without a framework to understand the eventual defeat. This explanatory vacuum made it hardly surprising that many Americans attributed the failure to internal factors like treason or lack of American will rather than examining the fundamental flaws in the intervention itself. The PBS Vietnam documentary series serves as a prime example of how media institutions approach balanced coverage through carefully constructed frameworks that exclude fundamental criticism of American aggression. While the series offers harsh criticism of French colonialism, it employs notably different terminology when describing American involvement, transforming Vietnamese rebels and nationalists into communists or the enemy. The possibility that America was effectively attacking South Vietnam remains unthinkable within the series' interpretive framework, demonstrating how even retrospective coverage maintains certain ideological boundaries. The U.S. conducted three distinct wars in Laos, bombing the Ho Chi Minh Trail, bombing the Peasant Society of Northern Laos, unrelated to the Vietnam War, and running a CIA mercenary war against Apatet Lao. While the southern bombing received some coverage, the systematic destruction of Northern Laos remained largely unreported despite compelling evidence. In July 1968, Jacques de Cornoy of Le Monde published eyewitness accounts of Northern Laos's devastation, describing a world without noise, where villages had disappeared, inhabitants hid in mountains, and towns were razed to the ground. Despite this evidence being repeatedly brought to American media's attention, it was suppressed. The New York Times avoided mentioning the civilian bombing campaign throughout 1968 and most of 1969, finally publishing T.D. Allman's October 1969 account confirming that the rebel economy and social fabric were the main United States targets. By then, the CIA's clandestine army had evacuated civilians from the Plain of Jars, where their harrowing stories were largely ignored by the media. Cambodia suffered terribly during what Finnish investigators called the Decade of the Genocide in the 1970s, which unfolded in three distinct phases. Phase 1, 1969 to April 1975, when unprecedented U.S. bombing and a U.S.-sustained civil war devastated the country. Phase 2, April 1975 to 1978, the murderous Khmer Rouge period ended by Vietnamese invasion. And Phase 3, when Vietnam installed the Hang Samrin regime while the U.S. and China supported the Khmer Rouge-dominated coalition. The three phases received dramatically different media treatment. Phase 1, for which the United States bore primary responsibility, was barely investigated and never described in the condemnatory terms applied to Phase 2. The Cambodians killed during American bombing were unworthy victims. Phase 2, the Pol Pot era, was immediately labeled a Holocaust comparable to Hitler's and Stalin's worst atrocities, with massive publicity and outrage over these worthy victims. Yet some Phase 2 deaths must be attributed to conditions left by the U.S. war, including widespread malnutrition, destroyed agriculture, and the psychological impact of bombing that transformed communists into totalitarian fanatics. In Phase 3, Cambodians regained worthy victim status, but now as sufferers under Vietnamese rule. The Vietnamese became the villains, while the U.S. supported China's punitive invasion of Vietnam and helped reconstruct the defeated Pol Pot forces. Media concentration has intensified dramatically since the book's first edition. Where 50 giant firms dominated mass media in 1983, by 1990 only 23 remained. Today, just 9 transnational conglomerates, including Disney, Comcast, News Corp, and ViacomCBS, control virtually all major film studios, TV networks, music companies, cable channels, and many publishers. These corporations now reach across multiple platforms, from traditional broadcast media to streaming services and digital content distribution. This consolidation has gone global, fueled by several interconnected factors: accelerated business globalization, explosive growth in advertising markets, particularly in developing economies, revolutionary advances in communications technology like 5G and satellite distribution, government deregulation policies, and the triumph of neoliberal free market ideology. The resulting media culture emphasizes consumerism and lifestyle themes that weaken community bonds essential to civic life, creating what media scholar Robert McChesney calls relentless, ubiquitous commercialism. News coverage increasingly focuses on sensationalism, celebrity gossip, and manufactured controversies rather than substantive policy issues or investigative reporting. When mass protests erupted against the World Trade Organization in Seattle, 1999, and against the International Monetary Fund and World Bank in Washington, D.C., 2000, media coverage was overwhelmingly derisive and hostile. Despite the presence of Nobel laureate economists, respected social theorists, labor leaders, and veteran organizers with coherent policy agendas, major outlets portrayed protesters primarily through violent imagery and dismissive stereotypes. Rather than exploring protesters' substantive concerns about environmental degradation, labor rights, and economic justice, outlets branded them as all-purpose agitators, terminally aggrieved, and simply against world trade. This pattern of delegitimization has continued in coverage of subsequent social movements. Labor issues and income inequality have faced similar treatment in mainstream media. From 1977 to 1999, while the top 1% saw income growth of 84.8% and the top 10% gained 44.6%, the bottom 60% lost ground, with the lowest 20%'s income falling by 12.5%. Despite this dramatic redistribution of wealth upward, mainstream media barely noticed this growing inequality until Pat Buchanan's populist outcries during the 1996 presidential campaign briefly forced attention to the issue. Even then, coverage focused more on personality and political strategy than systematic analysis of economic trends or policy solutions. The digital revolution, rather than democratizing media as some predicted, has largely reinforced these patterns of concentration and control. While social media and online platforms have created new channels for alternative voices, the dominant narratives are still shaped by a handful of corporate giants who have successfully extended their reach into the digital sphere through acquisitions, partnerships, and control of distribution networks. Despite structural changes strengthening the propaganda system, significant counterforces exist with growing potential for broader public access and alternative voices. Cable and satellite communications, though commercially dominated, have weakened the traditional network oligopoly and created opportunities for local access programming. Currently, over 3,000 public access channels produce approximately 20,000 hours of locally generated programming weekly, covering everything from community events to political discussions and cultural programming. Nonprofit radio and television stations, including over 900 public radio stations and 350 public television stations, provide direct media access opportunities that remain surprisingly underutilized in America. The internet has revolutionized information dissemination, creating unprecedented spaces for independent journalism and citizen media that can circumvent traditional gatekeepers. Independent news websites, investigative journalism platforms, and citizen journalists have successfully broken major stories ignored by mainstream outlets. Notable examples include early coverage of the Occupy Wall Street movement, police brutality cases, and corporate scandals. Social media platforms, despite their corporate ownership and algorithmic manipulation, have enabled rapid information sharing during crucial moments like the Arab Spring, Black Lives Matter protests, and environmental disasters, allowing suppressed stories to reach mass audiences through viral sharing. Chomsky and Herman strongly advocate for a two-pronged approach, containing growing media centralization while simultaneously encouraging grassroots movements and citizen groups to establish their own media channels. They point to successful models like the independent media centers established during the Seattle WTO protests and Washington, D.C. demonstrations, which provided real-time, unfiltered coverage from activist perspectives. These community-based broadcasting networks, combined with public access channels, alternative news websites, podcasts, and independent print media, create vital infrastructure for achieving democratic, social, and political progress. The propaganda model has gained rather than lost relevance since its introduction in 1988. The structural conditions underlying the model, ownership concentration, advertising dependency, reliance on official sources, flack, and ideological conformity have intensified in the digital age. Media conglomerates have grown larger, advertising has become more sophisticated, and government media relationships have tightened, especially post 9/11. Since these negative performance effects stem primarily from institutional structure and objectives, meaningful reform requires fundamental changes in media organization and operational goals. Democratic politics cannot function without democratized information sources and media systems that prioritize public interest over profit and power. As we navigate an increasingly complex information ecosystem, manufacturing consent provides essential tools for critical media analysis. The book challenges us to look beyond individual news stories to examine the institutional structures, economic incentives, and power relationships that determine which stories receive attention and how they're framed. Creating truly independent media that serves democratic values rather than entrenched interests requires both understanding these systemic forces and actively working to build alternative structures. The emergence of subscription-based journalism, crowd-funded news platforms, and cooperative media organizations offer promising models for future development.